Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today we visit the second annual Maine Biz Powering Up Maine Conference, co-sponsored by Maine Biz and the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Today's speaker is Dr. Habib Dagher, director of the Advanced Engineered Wood Composites Center at the University of Maine. Dr. Dagher is introduced by Carol Coltis, editor of Maine Biz.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. We're very excited to have you here today. It's my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Habib Dagher, director of AEWC Advanced Structures and Composites Center at the University of Maine. I'm hoping sometime they will shorten that name, sometime soon. The center was established by the National Science Foundation in 1996 and now employs 140 full and part-time people who work on the design and testing of integrated composite materials. Last year, the center's work on its bridge in a backpack, lightweight composite arches that replace heavy steel beams in bridge construction, earned national attention and resulted in a first-ever Trailblazer Award for Dr. Dagher from Composites Manufacturing Magazine. And in case you didn't get a chance to look at the New York Times today, it's featured prominently in a story in today's edition. And recently, it won praise and interest from the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, who is inviting Dr. Dagher to make a presentation before President Obama's Green Cabinet. This year, the focus has been on the center's work for the wind industry on blade and structure components and its pursuit of an offshore wind testing facility. $5 million has already been committed from the government, from the federal government, and more money is being sought, a necessary step in developing the $20 billion worth of far offshore wind power, wind farms, that can create up to 15,000 jobs and generate 5 gigawatts of power. Dr. Dagher recently returned from a trade mission to Europe, where he and Governor Baldacci signed an agreement with the Norwegian energy company to study whether its wind turbines are suitable for the Gulf of Maine. Later this month, he's off to the Netherlands for more wind power exploration. A professor of engineering, Dr. Dagher has received numerous awards, including the Carnegie Foundation Maine Professor of the Year, the New England Board of Higher Education Excellence Award, and the UMaine Presidential Research and Creative Achievement Award. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Dagher.
Thank you very much for the wonderful introduction. Can you hear me all right? This is the second best introduction I've had in my life. The best one was when the MC was late and I had to introduce myself. Today's talk is on deep water offshore wind and its potential in the state of Maine. I happen to serve on the governor's offshore or ocean energy task force. And just last week, the task force agreed to set a goal. And the goal is to produce 5 gigawatts of offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine by 2030. That's a major achievement for the task force. Some of the task force members are here. I see a lot of friends here who've been working with us on this program, on this effort for quite some time. The governor is very excited about where this could go. But before we talk about wind, it's really important to understand that this is not the only opportunity for Maine. As you know, renewables are like a mosaic. You got to look at a lot of options. This is one of the many options, and it's really important that we don't lose track of the importance of solar, lose track of the importance of other forms of energy as well. But today's topic happens to be offshore winds. We'll focus on that. This is some work that's been done close to a little over a year and a half ago, comparing Maine's family budget 10 years ago, last year, and 10 years from now. This is a... As you know, the average Maine family in Maine makes about $40,000. 10 years ago, in 1998, energy represented 5% of the family budget. Last year, if the July of last year's numbers held true for over a year, the average family in Maine would have spent 20% of its income on energy. When we say energy, we mean the gasoline for the two cars that the average family has, heating oil for the heating oil tank. Most of us use about 1,000 gallons of heating oil a year. We're the most heavily reliant state, as you know, on heating oil. So $1,000 times $4, that's just $4,000 on its own. Okay, so you can see how quickly the numbers do add up. 10 years from now, if we do nothing, the do-nothing scenario, and if you believe where oil prices might be going, I'm not an oil expert and don't pretend to be one, but I do read what the top oil experts tell us, and the top oil experts are all showing that hydrocarbon prices will be going up. It's just a matter of time in terms of as soon as the economy rebounds and things are going to start going back where we were. Actually, Merrill Lynch just last week announced $100 plus a barrel starting at the turn of next year. So we're going to be heading back in that direction. So by 2018, if any of the predictions that we have are right, we could be near $8 a gallon in gasoline costs in today's dollars. Could be. Nobody really knows for sure. And if we do, then 40% of the energy costs of the family budget would go to energy. So how do we deal with that? Electricity, as you know, is only a small fraction of the energy that we use. The energy as used in the country, as a state, is a lot more than just electricity. Electricity is less than 20% in most states of the total energy used. Where does our electricity in Maine come from right now? Where? Well, we actually do very well in terms of renewables. Between hydro, which is 25% of electricity in Maine, and wood biomass, which is another 22%, close to half of our electricity in Maine comes from renewable resources, so we do very well. So what are the options for Maine to create new energy and get off of fossil fuels? There's a very interesting statistic. If the average costs of gasoline and heating oil go up by $1, we in Maine pay out an extra $1 billion to $1.5 billion come out of the state of Maine for every dollar that gasoline price go up. We put out roughly every year, the state of Maine puts out, depending on the gasoline prices, $3 to $4 to $5 billion in hydrocarbon costs that leave the state of Maine. And every dollar gets it up by another $1 billion to $1.5 billion. So these are significant numbers. How do we reduce those costs? So you start, but you know, fossil fuels aren't going to go away overnight. We're going to be using them. We're going to continue to use them over the next 20 years. The question is, how do we reduce their impact on our economy and our energy independence? Is the question. You look at hydro. Can we do more hydro in Maine? Maine is now 25% hydro. 25% of our electricity comes from hydro in Maine. On the average across the country, that's about 7%. So Maine is a large hydro state. By any margin here, with 25% hydro, there's not a lot of opportunity for a lot more hydro. Maybe you can put another 200 megawatt of hydro in Maine, but not a lot more. So biomass, 23% of our electricity comes from biomass right now. However, how much more can we add to that before we start impacting the other industries in the state? And that's a very good question. Cellulosic ethanol is a technology the university is working very hard on. How far can we take that? How cost-effective will it be? Are good questions, but also things that we need to be looking at as part of our energy mosaic for the future. Solar needs to be here. Certainly, there's a lot of opportunities for solar in Maine. There's a lot of proposals in the southern part of the country here to do some solar work, additional solar work. The cost has to come down, but it will come down as time progresses. Onshore wind, there's a task force the governor put together that's proposing 3,000 megawatts of 3 gigawatts of offshore of land-based wind by 2020. That's very good. Hopefully we're on track, according to most experts, to get there. To put that in perspective, when we talk megawatts and gigawatts, if you're not in that business, maybe I'll try to help put that in perspective. A gigawatt, roughly, is a nuclear power plant. Maine Yankee used to be about 0.8 gigawatts. So a nuclear power plant equal roughly 1,000 megawatts equal 1 gigawatt. So that kind of helps put things in perspective. So when we say we're going to build 3,000 megawatts of land-based wind in Maine by 2020, we're saying that's the equivalent of 3 nuclear power plants, assuming the wind's blowing. Okay, when the wind isn't blowing, of course, we're not going to have those 3 nuclear power plants. That's what we talk about capacity factors in wind, because wind doesn't blow all the time. So how about tidal energy? There's estimates, various estimates. Currently, EPRI has a report, Electric Power Research Institute, on tidal energy in North America. The tidal potential in Maine ranges between a low of 25 megawatt to a high of 250 megawatt. And that's the total capacity in Maine. So something that can help spur some real opportunities, particularly in northeastern Maine. In Eastport, there's some real opportunities there. But it's not the gigawatts we're talking about. It's 250 megawatts at most. But really important in those areas. Wave energy is another area to look at. There's a lot of reports out there on wave energy. Some of the earliest report I've seen from EPRI say that Maine doesn't have a very good wave climate, but that's being contested right now. So the jury's out on that. Nuclear, should we be building more nuclear in Maine? It's a good question. If you go to France, France is 80% nuclear. If you travel north to Denmark, nobody wants nuclear in Denmark. They're all moving towards wind. So it's a choice that the population needs to make in terms of where we want to go. But today's focus is on offshore wind. We identified that offshore wind is the single largest renewable resource the state of Maine has for renewable energy. There's approximately 149 gigawatts of offshore wind capacity within 50 nautical miles of the coast of Maine. 149 gigawatts. What does that mean? If the wind's blowing at the right speed, that's the potential of 149 nuclear power plants out there. Of course, it's not going to be blowing all the time, so it's a fraction of that. If you take into account what we call capacity factors, the fact that the wind doesn't blow all the time, you can safely say we have the equivalent of 40 nuclear power plants worth of wind, including the intermittency of the wind, in the Gulf of Maine within 50 nautical miles. But that's just the capacity. It doesn't mean that we're going to go out and do that. You need to blanket the whole Gulf of Maine between the coast and 50 nautical miles with wind towers. And nobody wants to do that, of course. But it gives you an idea how much capacity there is out there. There's quite a bit of capacity. And clearly, from what we've looked at, the largest renewable resource the state of Maine has today. So we looked at all of them, and certainly that seems to be the big one to really focus on. I had the opportunity to make a presentation to U.S. Secretary Chu. That was back on June 5th of this year. The meeting was set up by Senator Susan Collins, and she's invited the rest of the delegation. So the whole delegation was present, as well as Governor Baldacci. They were all very good about this. To tell you, they said, "We're going to let you. You got half an hour. We're going to let you, Habib, talk for 15 minutes." And we're not going to let any of the other delegation members, they said that to themselves, talk, because otherwise there would be nothing else to say. I talked for 15 minutes, and the delegation chimed in. And what I'm going to do is show you a few slides that we presented to Secretary Hsu. This chart shows the ocean energy resource for the United States compared to the total electricity production used in the U.S. The United States utilizes 3,500, roughly, to 4,000 terawatt hours a year worth of electricity. Okay, that's how much electricity we use. That's the red column. The next column next to that, column two, to the right of that, is the offshore wind resource in the U.S. in waters of 100 feet of depth or more. So if you go to waters that are deeper than 100 feet and within 50 nautical miles of the U.S. borders, all around the United States, you could produce column two with the energy. Okay, you could see deep water wind is almost as big as the total electricity production of the United States. The third column to the right of that is shallow water winds. These are winds that blow in waters, over waters that are less than 100 feet deep. And you could see how much smaller that is versus deep water wind. The fourth column from the left, is wave energy across the United States, quite a bit there, but not as big as the rest. The fifth column is tidal and stream energy across the United States. And you can barely see that column right now. And then the last column on the right is ocean currents, like we're doing in Florida. That's the smallest of all the ocean energy renewables. When I showed this to Secretary Hsu, he was very amazed. He says, "I didn't know that. I didn't know offshore wind was almost as big within 50 miles as our entire electricity production. Where did you get these numbers from?" Being the Nobel laureate, he always asked tough questions. I said, "Mr. Secretary, it's your people who put this together." he was really pleased to hear that. It certainly awakened in him the need to really look at this technology and be able to move in that direction. what's disconcerting is that Europe is 10 to 15 years ahead of us right now in offshore wind technology. In addition to that, the European stimulus package had 575 million euros for R&D in renewable energy in offshore wind technology, and we had zero. So that was that was certainly an eye-opening to the secretary, and he was just an absolutely wonderful man, very bright, asked very good questions, and certainly I'm sure he's going to make an effort to change this. What we told the secretary is, it's all good for the U.S., but if we're going to create a national research effort to take the United States into the direction of deep water offshore wind, it should be in Maine. And why should it be in Maine? There's a number of reasons why it should be in Maine. 8% of that second column that you see out there, 8.3% of the offshore wind resource there, is off our coast in Maine. So we have 8.3% of the reserves of offshore wind in the United States, here in the Gulf of Maine. So it's like saying we have 8% of the oil reserves in the U.S. That's how important the resource is. The other thing that's important is that we have a wonderful industry infrastructure to allow us to deploy offshore wind technologies. If you look at our boat building industry, whether it's Bath Ironworks or we have companies such as Chimbrow, these are photographs on the lower right-hand corner of the two oil rigs that Chimbrow built here in the Portland seaport. These drill in 10,000 feet of water and can be positioned within plus or minus 6 inches untethered. And they were made here in Portland, Maine, and taken all the way to Brazil to drill in 10,000 feet worth of water. This is the kind of technology that can be built here in Maine. That's what we told the secretary. So not only do we have the resource, 8% of the U.S., but we also have the manufacturing base and infrastructure to do this kind of work. And that was very important to the secretary, to know that that can be done in Maine, should Maine be chosen to be the leader in this technology in the U.S. In addition to that, the university has been working for the last 50 years studying the Gulf of Maine. These are all the faculty who've gotten a lot of gray hairs figuring out what's going on in the Gulf of Maine. What we've done is taken all that information and put it together in an intelligent GIS database that has 200 layers of data right now that tell us all we think we know about the Gulf of Maine. That includes how deep the water is. That includes what kind of geophysical conditions we have under the sea. Is it rock? Is it sand? Is it clay? What are we dealing with out there? Where the shipping channels are, where the fishermen go, where the lobstermen go, and where they fish so we can stay away. And all kinds of other information in terms of wind over the Gulf of Maine. All of that is in one intelligent database right now, a 200-layer database that we're running right now. You can run on a laptop currently. And that was used to help identify up to 5 test sites that the state will be unveiling here on December 5th for testing offshore wind technology in the Gulf of Maine. These will be 5 test sites that have the least environmental impact or impact in the Gulf of Maine. So we're the only states who has these test sites and the first to have these test sites off of its shores. So that's what we told the secretary. And of course, if we're going to go ahead and build infrastructure like that 20 miles offshore, we want to build them with materials that will reduce corrosion. So advanced materials is a key technology that we're going to be using in developing this infrastructure offshore. And Maine is a leader in that technology at the university. The other thing to think about from our viewpoint is where do we live in Maine? If we think of a business plan for the state of Maine, what are we going to do over the next 20 to 30 years? How do we put ourselves on a map as a state? As you know, we're blessed with a lot of natural resources. We're larger than all New England states put together. We have the longest seacoast on the east coast of the United States. If you stretch it out, it's longer than anyone's seacoast. But this is a wind resource map of the United States. The areas in white is an area where there is no wind. The areas that are colored have different amounts of wind. Yellow, as you get darker and darker, you have better winds. Yellow is the lightest winds. Of course, white is no wind. Yellow is the lightest winds. Pink is a better wind. Purple is even better wind. Red is what we call outstanding wind. And blue is superb wind. So if you look at the Midwest, which is what we call T. Boone Pickens Corridor, T. Boone Pickens wants to build wind towers up in the Midwest and build $80 billion worth of transmission lines from the Midwest up to the East Coast. But if you look at that, they don't. You know, the Midwest does not have the best winds in the world or in the United States. The best winds occur off our shores. That's the areas in red. Not only in Maine, but throughout the East Coast, you see a lot of red areas. If you go to the Gulf of Mexico, those winds actually drop down quite a bit. But looking at that, the other important piece in this puzzle is every black dot on this map, the small black dot on the map, is 7,500 people. So when you see a lot of black dots together, there's a lot of people living there. So you ask yourself, where are the people living in this country? The majority of the people are in the Northeast. That's the largest concentration of black dots, almost like a big black area near the coast in the Northeastern United States. If you took the state of Texas and stretch it across the Northeastern U.S., you capture 55 million people. That's 18% of the U.S. population. So we can think of ourselves in the Northeastern states. That includes, of course, New England, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. We are like a big state, like a Texas-sized state. And it's the largest state by population in the country that pays the highest electricity rates in the country as well. And so we happen to be living in a very busy neighborhood, okay, and a neighborhood that's going to require a lot of renewable energy. And our business plan as a state could be to be an exporter of clean energy to the other states, not just a point of transit, but an exporter of clean energy to the rest of the Northeastern U.S. That's an ambitious plan. To put that in perspective, think about having 40 nuclear power plants of wind off the coast of Maine within 15 miles and 55 million people who need renewable energy over the next 10 to 20 to 30 years. So that's putting the two together. This chart shows the renewable energy, renewable electricity production requirements that each state in New England has enacted by law. And those are plotted through 2020. So if you go from the left, you're 2007, to the right of the chart is 2020. The vertical axis is the renewable energy requirement added up for all New England states. Okay, that's by law. What you see in dark green on the very top of that is the unmet requirement. That means we don't know where this energy, clean energy by law, enacted by the states, is going to come from. So think about the opportunity that we have then for America to fill that need that's already on the books by law. So we have some opportunity. So what's the plan? Clearly, Maine is not really a big energy consumer. If you look at how we use electricity, we're a summer peaking state. We use about 2.4 gigawatts of electricity in the summer. So 2.4 nuclear power plants takes care of all of our electricity needs at the heat of the summer when people in Portland turn the air conditioners on. That's when we get the peak. We're a summer peaking state right now. So 2.4 gigawatts is all we need. So what do we do with another 5 gigawatts or 8 gigawatts, by the matter? What do we do with all that? How do we use it? What does that do to our electrical system? Do we have the transmission infrastructure to get it out to market? Can we build it in Maine? These are all very important questions. Looking at the plan, we're recommending 5 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030. That's 5 nuclear power plants worth when the wind's blowing. The land-based wind task force recommended 3 gigawatts by 2020. So you add the two up, that's 8 gigawatts of wind going into a state that only uses 2.4 gigawatts of electricity. Okay, so that's a lot of wind, a lot of energy. What do we do with all of it? How do we use it in Maine? Where do these numbers come from? There's a lot of study that went behind these numbers. Obviously, we're going to have to export some of it. Is it okay to export electricity from Maine? Is it not? Well, I asked people. Some people feel that we shouldn't be building electrical facilities in Maine, and so the folks in Boston can turn their lights on. But think of it this way. What if we had to eat all the lobsters that come out of the state of Maine here in Maine? Would we have a lobster industry? Okay, and we'd have to do it. We need to think of clean electrons leaving the state of Maine as another export that can help hopefully create jobs in Maine if we do it right, of course. And there needs a lot of planning to figure out how to do that. So what's the plan? If we put 5 gigawatts of offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine, that's a $20 billion investment, private investment, of course, into the state of Maine, $20 billion. The land-based investment, 3 gigawatts by 2020, is another about $7 billion investment. Together, that's a $27 billion investment in plant and equipment for wind energy in the state of Maine. If you went out there and told industry around the world that that you have a $27 billion project in the state of Maine, can you get their attention? And that's the key to be able to attract businesses and grow jobs in the state of Maine. If we keep building small wind farm facilities, such as what we have in northern Maine, whether it's Mars Hills or Stetson Mountain and so forth, that's great. But that's not going to attract the blade manufacturers here. There's not enough of a market to put a plant together. You got to keep people busy and have a scale of a plant that's going to have enough output. And that's why it's critical for us, if we're going to attract businesses, as you asked, you formulated your question here, to have a bold plan. And what did T. Boone Pickens do? He said, I want to build 5 gigawatts in Texas. Isn't that what he said? And then every single manufacturer of wind energy was out there talking to him in Texas. Well, we can do the same thing in Maine. Instead of being 5 gigawatts, it's going to be 8 gigawatts. Five offshore and 3 on land. But how do we use it? The way to use it is to help get ourselves off of fossil fuels, which are going to get more and more expensive over time. One way to use it is to in plug-in hybrid vehicles over time. There's a think tank that sits on top of DOE and helps the Department of Energy develop plan the future. The think tank put together a report that was published a few months ago, and the report tried to ask a question: what's the best way to integrate an intermittent resource into our system without essentially taxing the system significantly? The number one recommendation was plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. And that's why the Obama administration now is spending a lot of its resources trying to figure out how to build electrical vehicles. The batteries, particularly, is the key component of that. So what can plug-in hybrid vehicles do for us? The state of Maine has about 500,000 cars. Think about, we don't know what battery, what the capacity of each battery is. But let's say each battery is going to be in the order of 10 kilowatt, anywhere from 5 to 10 kilowatt. If it's 10 kilowatt times 500,000 cars, that's a 5 gigawatt super battery distributed across the state of Maine. So if we're creating a lot of wind energy at 2 o'clock in the morning in the Gulf of Maine or in northern Maine in land-based wind, and we don't know where it's going to go, well, if we had a whole bunch of these cars plugged in, we can pretty much take as much of that energy as it comes. So it could be a big storage battery, and that's what's being proposed to DOE at the national level. And as you know, the major car manufacturers are moving in that direction. GM hopefully will unroll next year its Chevy Volt. The Chevy Volt is a plug-in hybrid vehicle. What's unique about it is different than the Prius. What's unique about it is that it has a 300-pound lithium-ion battery that you can plug in at night, and it'll fill up overnight, or in 3 to 4 hours, depending on your service, and then you can drive 40 miles with no gasoline. But then it has a gasoline tank in it as well that actually recharges the battery when the battery loses its charge. So you can travel 300 to 400 miles on a tank and a full charge, just like you would in any other vehicle. GM is hoping this will transform GM. This particular vehicle will transform GM. Just not too long ago, the car show in Europe, every single car manufacturer in Europe was touting plug-in hybrid vehicles of some sort. That's where things seem to be moving. Where the future will go, nobody really knows. I heard a very interesting saying once: the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And that's essentially what a lot of companies are trying to do, is invent the future. The state of Hawaii, the governor in Hawaii a few months ago, made a major announcement to electrify streets and neighborhoods in Hawaii to use these plug-in hybrid vehicles. A company called Better Place out of California, along with the government, are investing close to $1 billion to electrify streets and neighborhoods in Hawaii. And the governor in Hawaii has also signed some contracts with Nissan and Renault to provide the electrical vehicles for the program. So you can go in there anywhere on the streets, in the designated streets where this will take place, plug in your car, and be able to charge while you work at home, or while you work in your office. And then, those things are happening right now, and there are studies that show that with the right incentives, it is entirely likely that 50% of our vehicles between now and 2030 could be some form of a plug-in hybrid vehicle. Of course, how fast will that happen? Nobody really knows. It's going to be driven very much by the cost of fuel. If gasoline costs go up to $6 and $7 a gallon, we'll all be rushing to try to do something different. And whether it's electrical vehicles or hydrogen vehicles or natural gas vehicles, who really knows? But certainly there's a lot of momentum today behind the electrical vehicle technology. The other piece that's very important is home heating in Maine. As you know, we're the most heavily reliant state on home heating oil. We could potentially, over time, over 20 years, also transform a lot of that heating oil block into other technologies. There's, of course, solars could be a piece of it and others. But one of the technologies that has a lot of promise is air-to-air heat pumps as well as geothermal heat pumps driven by electricity. Those could potentially reduce significantly, I'll show you some numbers, the cost of home heating for the average family in Maine. So if we're to start transforming our vehicle fleet into an electrical vehicle fleet, so we're not using as much oil anymore, gasoline, and did the same thing with heating and transformed that over time, we're going to need a lot more electricity. So all of a sudden, those 2 gigawatts of electricity or 2.4 gigawatts that we use are no longer enough, and we need to go beyond that. So how we use electricity, and if we change that over 20 years, we might find ourselves indeed needing an extra 5 gigawatts in Maine. And we've run some numbers that show that. The Ocean Energy Institute has also run some numbers along those lines that show that if you transform every car in Maine into a plug-in hybrid vehicle over the next 20 years, and if you transformed every house into some form of heat pump, you would need another 5 gigawatts of wind. That's where the 5 gigawatts come from. But, of course, we're not going to use it all. We need to also export some of it. And that's very important. When you think about wind, you say, okay, you really can't run the state on wind. It's impossible. Okay, what would happen if your computer comes off when the wind dies? That's not going to work very well. So what we need to do is look at other ways of balancing the uncertainty in the wind. And the way the Europeans are doing it, I'm going to take you to Denmark. Denmark has the highest penetration of wind energy in the world today. 21% of Denmark's electricity comes from wind. So how do they balance the grid when 21% of that resource is uncertain? Okay, what they do is they've got to deal with Norway and a few other countries in their neighborhood. And Norway, of course, has a wonderful hydro resource. So when Denmark is producing a lot of electricity and can't use it internally at 2 o'clock in the morning, for example, when the wind's really blowing in Denmark, well, they sell electricity north to Norway. And if they're not producing enough wind, then they would buy electricity back. So Norway is acting almost like a battery for Denmark. Now, could we think of a similar scenario in Maine where potentially Hydro-Québec, who has a lot of hydro capacity too, could be a battery for Maine? We need to be thinking regionally. We need to think in beyond our region as well. We need to look at our neighbors in the north and neighbors in the south. And a plan that's successful to integrate a large uncertain resource need to include our neighbors. We can't do it alone. It's got to be a regional approach to do these things. I show you here the transmission issue is a key issue in the state. In order for any of this to work, we need to develop a more robust transmission system. That could be by land, by sea. There's an opportunity for us to have undersea cables as well to take some of this resource beyond the state of Maine. So how much can we save by 2020 if we electrify transportation and if we electrify heating in the state of Maine? These are some scenario numbers, and they're based on assumptions. If you assume by 2020, gasoline and fuel oils would be at $10 a gallon, okay, that's in today's dollars. And these numbers come from Charlie Maxwell. Charlie Maxwell is ranked as the number one oil analyst in the world. So this is not my numbers. That's his assumption. So assuming he's right, or anywhere close to being right, if we're at $10 a gallon by 2020, what does that mean? The left-hand slide shows what the cost of transportation would be, heating and electricity. Transportation, the 2 cars the average family has, would cost $12,500 to run. Heating would be at $10,000 to run, and that's not difficult to get at. The average family uses about 1,000 gallons of heating oil a year, $10 a gallon, that's $10,000. So the numbers aren't very difficult to get at. But when you start adding them up, when you say, wow, is that really going to happen? And what would happen if this indeed becomes a scenario? So transportation, $12,500 for the 2 cars, $10,000 for heating, $2,500 for electricity. That's a lot more than more than 50% of the average family income. So certainly it's not a sustainable scenario. If we were to use electricity for heating and transportation, even if electricity is at 37.5 cents a kilowatt hour, we would save $16,000 for the family's average energy costs. So the scenario works. We just have to, certainly that's one scenario. Now, what's not looked into here is using wood pellets, for example, for heating. That could also be a piece of something we should look at. Solar heating as well are some things we should look at. This happens to only look at wind and transforming heating and using a wind resource. So what does offshore wind look like from a technology viewpoint? The technology varies depending on how deep the water is. And the penetration of the technology is essentially in Europe today. If you are in water depth between 0 and 100 feet, the technology is very well known in Europe. People are doing this every day. I'll show you some examples in just a minute. What you typically would do if you have the right soil conditions, you drive a big pile into the seabed using a big jack-up barge. These piles could be up to 16 to 20 foot in diameter, 2-inch thick steel, driven into the seabed using huge impact hammers, essentially. As you might imagine, that's not cheap. There's not a lot of jack-up barges to do this kind of work out there. Actually, in the U.S., there are none today. Because of the Jones Act, the jack-up barges, about 10 of them in Europe, can't really operate in the U.S. either. So we have a challenge to build some boats if we want to do this. The other issues that happen if you want to build some of this infrastructure is you have to protect the environment around it. Think about these big impact hammers driving an 18-foot diameter pile into the seabed. The pressure and the sound that comes out of that is damaging to a lot of sea life. So what they do in Europe is actually use an air jacket. You drive an air jacket and air around the area before you actually drive the pile in to isolate the area from transmission of energy to the seabed. So it's being done. What are the costs in Europe today for shallow water wind? There's a report that you can get online from the European Wind Energy Association that tells you what those costs are. The report shows 10 different offshore wind farms in Europe that have been operating since 2001 and provides those costs. The costs range from 6.5 eurocents per kilowatt hour all the way up to 9 eurocents per kilowatt hour. So that's the range today. So what's the standard offer in Maine today? Yeah, that includes transmission, though. But if you look at the generation side, we're not too far off. If you assume a eurocent is equivalent to a U.S. dollar, to U.S. cents, but that's a question to be addressed at a later time. But again, we're not too far off from a cost viewpoint, and the costs are expected to drop significantly in offshore wind. There's the experience over the last 20 years is that the learning curve has a 10% coefficient for land-based wind, which means every time you double the installed capacity, you reduce the cost by 10%. That's been true for land-based wind for the last 20 years. Okay? So if you assume a same learning curve, a 10% learning curve for offshore wind will be competitive with traditional sources and is being close to being competitive right now in Europe. So now let's go to deeper waters. If you go to waters between 100 to 200 feet of depth, the story changes. The foundation systems, which is a third picture there, becomes more costly. You have to bigger foundations, and the costs do escalate significantly. Now, the majority, over 90% of what's out there today and planned today is shallow water wind, less than 100 feet deep. In Europe, there are three installations between 100 and 200 feet deep. If you go over 200 feet deep, it's not cost-effective anymore to have a foundation all the way to the seabed because it gets too deep and too costly. So that's a realm of research today. And researchers across the globe, all the way from Japan to Europe, are racing to figure out how to build floating wind turbines. Okay, what are floating wind turbines? Think of a boat that has a very big mast on it. On the very top of the mast, you have a windmill. Okay, and then you anchor that boat to the seabed 20 miles offshore. That's kind of a simple representation of a floating wind turbine. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about borrowing from 40 years of experience in the offshore oil drilling industry. And as you know, in the offshore oil drilling industry, there's floating platforms, such as tension leg platform and spar designs are used for oil drilling in thousands of feet of water, taking that technology and adapting it to wind turbines. We're not going to use the same size structures. In the offshore wind world, some of these structures are 300 feet in diameter. We're not going to do that here. We're looking at quite a bit smaller structures adapted to wind energy. How big are these floating turbines? It depends on the size of the turbine, but they need to be in a 5 to 6 megawatt range to pay for themselves. 5 to 6 megawatt is a fairly large unit. As you know, in Mars Hills, we're looking at 1.5 megawatt turbines. So that's a much larger turbine. How high are they? About 300 feet above the water. This is an example of a foundation for medium depth waters in Europe. We were down in Europe 2 weeks ago, toured in Bremen and Bremerhaven in northern Germany. They're out there making these right now. For the North Sea, up in the port there. This is a tripod design that's used in waters near 80 feet deep. This is another design for deeper waters. It's called a jacket design or jacket platform. It's like a transmission structure, a lattice structure that's under the water, and then the water level comes up to about here, and everything here is below the water. Again, that's another way to cut the foundation costs down and build the structures. That happens to be sitting on land in northern Germany, being tested on land before it goes into the water. That we took that picture 2 weeks ago. This is a port facility in Bremerhaven, where they've essentially made an offshore tech park in the area where hundreds of people are employed currently. What you see in the very background with the crane, that's another tripod for a deep water wind foundation, for an offshore wind platform. What you see here are manufacturing facilities for blades right next to it, and the port's sitting right there. So what you do here, so the key here is port infrastructure, having a port infrastructure that can allow you to do these things. The blade manufacturing facility employed 500 people. They were making 180-foot long blades, okay, that are taken right into a barge, and they're taken to a project 40 kilometers north of Germany, the island of Juist in Germany. It's a 1,000-megawatt offshore wind farm about 30 miles north of Germany, okay, into the sea. But they're lucky. They have water depth less than 100 feet. In Maine, we're not that lucky. If you go about 3 miles off the coast of Maine, 3 nautical miles, the water depth is about 200 feet. So we're 200 feet at 3 miles. They're out there, you know, 30 miles away and less than 100 feet. So they've got it a lot easier than we do. But we believe that in the long run, floating offshore wind platforms could become, as they could become, based on what we think, less expensive than fixed-base platforms. Why? Because you could potentially build them in a dry dock facility like Bath Ironworks does right now, flood it and tow the thing out to sea. So you're always working in a very protected environment. You're not out there with a jack-up barge trying to pound a 20-foot diameter pile into the seabed. You're doing everything in a protected facility so you can actually transform the boat building industry into an industry that can manufacture these components onshore and then tow the whole thing out to site. That's what we envision could be a future. This is some of the turbines, 5 to 6 megawatt turbines, in Bremerhaven being, and then the foundations in the background, all being done in one facility, one big port facility. Where should that be in Maine? Where should we have a facility like that? And these are some of the planning issues that we need to look at. Where does it make sense to do something like that in Maine? Now, when we talk about offshore wind, what is it? What does 5 gigawatt mean? Does that fit in with national plans, or is it just a Maine plan? And we're alone in the world thinking that way in the U.S. Well, we're not alone in the U.S. thinking that way, and that's important to know. Actually, there's a lot of competition out there. There's a plan developed by the U.S. Department of Energy during the Bush administration. It's called the 20% by 2030 plan. How many of you have seen that plan? Okay, yes. What is that plan? That plan's called for 20%, a goal of 20% of the U.S. electricity to come from wind by 2030. Okay. The plan didn't come out of the blue. There was a lot of smart people in the transmission industry, in the supply chain industry, in the wind industry. They all got together and figured out what's a reasonable goal for the U.S. What's good is that this plan was developed during the Bush administration, was also adopted by the Obama administration. So that's the Bush-Obama plan, right? Okay. So the plan is to reach 20% wind by 2030. The plan calls for about 350 gigawatts of wind by 2030. Okay. Of that, 54 gigawatts is from offshore wind. That's the national plan. If you take the top 10 offshore states and say the 54 gigawatts will come from the top 10 states, divide that by 10, that's 5 gigawatts. So each one of the top 10 states would produce 5 gigawatts. So what we told Secretary Hsu is the state of Maine can help you reach your goal of 20% goal by providing the 5 gigawatts. And he liked that very much. So Here's where things will look like. What things would look like by 2015 for wind energy, offshore wind energy, in Europe and North America. You have a hard time finding the United States, don't you? Okay. This is the offshore wind installation by 2015. And what you see for the U.S., 2,000 megawatts for the United States, that assumes Cape Winds gets built. Okay, and that's a big assumption if we get Cape Winds gets built by 2015. The Germany is going to have about 11 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2015. And the U.K. is going to have, would be a close second, at close to 9 gigawatts of offshore wind. The U.K. is moving aggressively very quickly right now. They just did their third round of tenders for offshore wind. They've ordered some farms already, offshore wind farms, in the size of 1,000 megawatt for the farm. It doesn't look like it's going too far. It's trying. Okay, that's good. That's good. So the U.S. is only at about 2,000 megawatts. So we have some work to do. We had an opportunity about 2 weeks ago to travel to Norway. Norway is a lot like Maine. The coast of Norway drops off very quickly, just like the coast of Maine does. So they have very deep waters off the coast of Norway. There's a company called Statoil Hydro. How many of you have heard of Statoil Hydro? Okay, Statoil Hydro is one of the largest oil companies in the world. It used to be Statoil. And they merged with a company called Hydro, and they're Statoil Hydro. They believe the future is in renewables, even though they're an oil exploration company. They've been out there for 40 years looking for oil in the North Sea. So they know they know everything about oil. But here we go. Wonderful. Wonderful. So this is a shot of offshore of the first operating floating wind tower in the world. This tower. Is it called spar design? What is a spar? It's like a big tube, okay? And the tube gets wider under the water than it is over the water. There's a big mass, rocks and water, at the bottom of the tube to keep it up. Think about if you took a 2x4, 2x4, 8-footer piece of wood, and hung some steel at one end of it. What would happen to it? And you threw it in the water. If the metal isn't heavy enough, what would happen? It will straighten up, stand up like that. That's exactly what a spar is. So a spar is how big is the spar that we looked at out there? It's 213 feet from the water level to the hub, 20 feet in diameter at the water level, and gets wider under the water. It's 300 feet below the water. So this structure is 500 feet tall from the bottom to the top, okay? That's a 2.3 megawatt turbine. The turbine weight is 138 tons, sitting 213 feet up in the air. This is a project that Statoil Hydro started working on in 2001 because they realized they don't have shallow waters off of Norway. So they figured out, well, we're an offshore oil drilling company. We've been out there working in the environment for 30 to 40 years. We know something about that environment. We know how to build stuff out there. So what they did is develop the research since 2001, and a little over a year and a half ago decided they're going to build one. So they invested $70 million to build the first floating wind turbine in the world. They deployed it about a month ago. We had an opportunity to go see it, but I'm going to show you some pictures first of the construction. The upper left-hand corner right here shows the diameter in the shop. It was manufactured in Finland, actually, and was towed by sea to Norway. It's 20 feet in diameter. You could see that being done. There's no reason why Chimbro or Bath Iron Works or somebody in the composites business could make it out of composites potentially here in Maine. Then the base unit, which is wider near the bottom, was towed from Finland, and it was towed to about 1/6 of a mile off a city called Stavanger, Norway. Stavanger is on the southwest corner of Norway. And Stavanger is a beautiful city near the waterfront, kind of like Portland, Maine. And they decided they're going to actually write this thing up in front of everybody so everybody get to see it. So it was the biggest spectacle in Stavanger, Norway. Everybody wanted to was out watching this thing. So it was horizontally towed about 1/6 of a mile. And then there was ballast placed on one side, water ballast. And then the whole thing tipped up vertically in the middle of the bay. So think about sitting on your on the shore watching this thing tip up. That's over 300 feet long. And then after it was tipped up, then a barge came up to it and held onto it so it doesn't move as much anymore with respect to the barge. And then there was two sections of the tower put on. And then the blade assembly was placed in the water. It took about 11 hours to put the blade assembly in the water. That was the trickiest piece because you've got a moving barge and you're trying to put a large blade assembly up 213 feet in the air. But it took him about 11 hours. They're very proud of it. It's operating right now, so we got a chance to see it with the governor. These are some shots we took about 2 weeks ago in Stavanger, Norway. This is a close-up view of the bottom part. You can see here the ladders. There's a door right here. There's a ladder. So you can see how big this thing is. There's a ladder right here coming up. There's a little balcony right here that gives you an access door to go inside of this 23-foot diameter near the water. This is the actual structure. The tower came in two pieces. This is one lift, and the other lift is above. This is the boat that we took out to see this from. It's really interesting. We're meeting with the senior vice president from Cerro Hidro. And ahead of time, I told them the governor is coming, and we definitely need to see this. And if the sea gets rough, we still need to see this. So I asked for a helicopter. And they've agreed after we signed our lives away to have a helicopter available for us. So we had a helicopter. We had a meeting. The governor was there. And we asked the governor. The news came in. There were 6-foot waves out there, governor. It could be pretty rough out there. Would you want to take the helicopter or do you want to take the boat? And he didn't hesitate a second. He says, I'm taking the boat. I really need to feel how the sea feels out there. And that gives me better appreciation of what's out there. So we went on a two hours plus trek, 25 miles, from Stavanger, Norway, to the open sea, to the North Sea. And as soon as we got out of the bay, you couldn't even stand up on that boat. You had to hold on for your life, essentially. The boat was going like this. Even though it was a 100-person boat, it was a catamaran made out of composites. Catamaran. So I had good faith in it. Actually, we know what the design looks like. But we were shaken up pretty well by the time we got there. But when we got there, what's very interesting is we kept looking for this thing to see if it's going to move at all. It was not moving a bit, not a single bit. And we kept looking at this. It was just, there was no movement at all, even though the boat was rocking back and forth like wanting to throw us out of the boat. But the answer is very simple. The waves were 6 feet. This thing is 300 feet below the wave line. It doesn't care what happens up near the top where there's 6-foot waves. That's the idea behind this thing. And then they've designed it so that they could take a standard turbine for land-based wind and place it up there as long, of course, as you vacuum seal, you seal the turbine housing so you don't have corrosion issues. This is the governor. Notice he's smiling after a two-hour rocking ride all the way up with Jack Cashman, of course, who definitely wanted to come back to Maine. And you can see the floating unit. That's, again, 25 miles up in the open sea in an OC. So it is doable. It is feasible. And what we wanted to do in Maine is not have to start from scratch. So we signed an agreement with the Norwegians to work with them. They're willing to come and work with us to evaluate the possibility of using this technology off the Gulf of Maine. So they'll be coming up here in mid-November. We're going to have a meeting, and they're going to give a presentation. Everybody interested, I'll let you know when the meeting is. We're going to invite industry from across the state to participate in this effort as well, this meeting. So what's our goal? Our goal actually is very simple. We're going to learn to walk before we run and crawl before we walk. So our goal is to go ahead and build a smaller unit in the water and then gradually build bigger units. And not, so we can all figure out how to make these components in Maine. So our first goal is to establish a deep water wind test bed. The sites will be announced on December 5th. We're going to be looking at all these technologies, not just the spar design. The spar design, this is a design that Cerro Hidro built, but we're looking at tension leg platforms and also semi-submersible designs. All of those are designs that are worthwhile looking at this stage of the game. It's too early to tell which design is going to win out at this stage. And there might be more than one design depending on the geophysical conditions and water depth. So we need to look at all of them at this stage of the game. We're going to go out there, and we just received funding from the National Science Foundation to actually build prototypes of these designs about 10 feet high and put them in wave testing tanks up at Cadrock down in Washington, D.C., and put it through the waves and put them through windstorms and see how they hold up. And then we're going to pick a design, and then go to a 10 to 100 kilowatt unit and get it into the water by April 2011. In the meantime, we're working with Statoil Hydro, and their goal is to get a unit in a 3 to 6 megawatt range in the water as well. That's going to cost $50 million to do. The Statoil Hydro project requires quite a bit of investment. What we plan to do, we can do quite a bit less expensively. Once we built the 5-megawatt unit in the water and watch it for 2 years and make sure we shake the bugs out of it, essentially, the next step that we'd like to do is expand that to a floating farm, the first floating farm in the world, that would have, say, 10 2-megawatt units or 4 or 5-megawatt units. We're thinking a 20 to 30-megawatt range would be a good size for a realistic first floating farm demonstration project. Now, we're going to be putting these way offshore. The goal here is to go 20 miles. You remember the ones that we went to visit? It was 25 miles from the shore, right? When you go that far away, you don't see them anymore, okay? Because the curvature of the Earth, they essentially drop off. The Earth actually drops off more than 500 feet after you go 20 miles. So you don't see these things. You don't even see the blades when they're straight up. So we can protect the beauty of the coastal Maine, yet at the same time have the clean energy, and that's the goal. Our goal is not to go close to shore. I personally believe that we have a beautiful state, we have a beautiful coastline, we can protect it, and at the same time we could still have what we want by going 20 miles offshore. So our goal is the floating design technology. Now, this is an open field. Nobody in the world is leading floating offshore technologies. There are no floating offshore farms. So there's a real opportunity for us in Maine to grab a hold of this and become a leader in that technology. Statoil Hydro and others we're working with, they're really interested at the end of the day to build large farms. Our goal in working with them, the agreement we signed, is to get up to about a 500-megawatt farm. Okay, that's what we'd like to do. How big is a 500-megawatt farm? It's roughly 8 miles by 4 miles. That's how big that up in the open sea, 20 miles offshore. So 8 miles by 4 miles gives you roughly a 500-megawatt farm. You want them to be that big because of logistics and the cost of the cabling and so forth. You want to have something of that sort. Everything we're doing here today at the university, all the research we're doing, the whole goal is to get to that farm. So the goal is get to a 500-megawatt farm, but you got to take some steps. You got to build mama bear and baby bear, then mama bear, then papa bear, then family bear before you get into the whole town. So what we need to do is work our way up and learn as we go. The reason we want to do a demonstration floating farm first is to help maximize the supply chain in the state of Maine. As you know, we're going to create jobs if industry in Maine can step up to the table and has the time to step up to the table and get to the point where we could do this. This is I want to show you a couple of shots. This is the largest offshore wind farm that's under current contract north of Germany. It's about 40 kilometers north of the German island of Juist. It has 960 megawatt, covers about an 8 mile by 8 mile area. And we saw the turbines being made when we were in northern Germany for that project. So this is real. It is happening today. It's just a matter for us in Maine to figure out how to get on to move forward and do this work. Jobs in the wind industry in Europe, because you've asked the question of jobs, these are predictions of the European Wind Energy Association. By 2030, they expect to have more jobs in offshore wind than in land-based wind in Europe because, of course, they're landlocked. They've taken all the best places in Europe for land-based wind, and they're going offshore. How about Maine? What is the potential scenario for Maine? Let us say we go ahead and we start building the 5 gigawatts of offshore wind, floating offshore wind, way offshore, 20 miles offshore in Maine. Let's say this is our plan. We all agree to do so. We move forward. How much is that going to cost? That's roughly, including transmission, a $20 billion project, $20 billion. How fast are we going to build it? We really don't know. We can build it in 10 years. We could build it in 20 years. Frankly, it all depends on how oil prices do. If oil prices go up very quickly, I think a lot of us would be looking at alternatives. Let us say we have a 20-year scenario at this point in the game. If it's at 20 years and $20 billion over 20 years is roughly $1 billion investment into the Maine economy every year for 20 years. How many jobs can that create? That's a very good question. Now, our federal government actually has some numbers for us. After a lot of debate, a lot of contentious debate, the federal government says exactly that. We can create 15.6 jobs for every $1 million invested in renewable energy. OK, Okay. Now, when we say 15.6 jobs, you really need to read behind the words. It's 15.6, not permanent jobs, but person-year jobs. So it's 15.6 jobs for 1 year for every $1 million invested in renewable energy. That's the number that the federal government is currently using. If we use that number, so essentially, what kind of jobs are these? All kinds of jobs, anywhere from technicians to laborers to engineers to everything put together. That's what the government is using. So if you take that number and say it's $1 billion a year over 20 years, multiply that by 15.6 per million, that's about 15,600 jobs that would be created. But that, of course, assumes that the entire supply chain is in the state of Maine. Let me give you how this can become quicksands for you if you start reporting 15,600 jobs. If we don't make the turbines in Maine, the jobs are cut in half. Okay, so it's critical to maximize the supply chain in the state of Maine. So half of those jobs, roughly, are the turbines and the blades. Okay, 30% of the jobs are actually manufacturing the towers and the components and deploying them to sea. There's also power collection is 10%. Installation and power management and so forth are all components of the infrastructure. So this is what the kind of jobs you're going to have. But again, to maximize the impact, you need to maximize the supply chain in the state of Maine. And then how do we attract the turbine manufacturer to Maine? The majority of wind energy jobs in Europe right now are concentrated in three countries. That's Denmark, Germany, Denmark, Germany, and Spain. These are the three countries that have the majority of the jobs in wind energy in Europe. Why? Because they're the turbine manufacturers. That's where they make the turbines. Okay. So if we're going to make a difference and create lots of jobs, we need to attract turbine manufacturers to Maine. And how we're going to attract them is by presenting a plan, a 5-gigawatt plan. That gets their attention. Okay. Stetson Mountain and others are great projects, but that doesn't attract manufacturers to come to Maine and set up. You've got to make it worth their while. So declaring a 5-gigawatt plan will make a difference, and manufacturers will start wanting to come to Maine. The other piece that's really important is how to maintain such an infrastructure. The estimates, maintenance costs, could run close to 2.5% of capital investments every year. So if you have a $20 billion capital plant in the water 20 years from now, that's going to require $500 million a year in maintenance and operating costs. So think about the jobs that would create. Think about lobstermen and others who are actually transforming, and when they're not getting lobsters, they're out there actually part of the maintenance crews and being retooled to do that work. And they're very interested to do so because they're not working full-time, as you know. They're out there working only part-time. These are the kinds of things that we could be doing. Building the ships for that infrastructure is also very critical. What kind of ships do we need to build this kind of infrastructure, tow it, and maintain it are part of what needs to happen. But more important than that, if we become the central focus of this kind of technology, floating wind technology in the United States, we're not going to just be building here in Maine. Companies in Maine becomes consultants for companies across the country and the world. So that also creates a lot more job opportunities beyond that. How about beyond the 20 years or 25 years lifetime of these structures? After 20 to 25 years, the Germans are already planning what they call a repowering program. The Germans love to plan, and they're really wonderful planners. And they're already planning in 25 years what they're going to do with these offshore structures. And their plan is to actually take the turbines off 25 years from now or 20 years from now, put better turbines on that actually produce more power, because in 20 years we're going to have better turbines. And that's going to actually help produce more power into the future and maintain the job growth. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Dr. Habib Dagher, Director of the Advanced Engineered Wood Composites Center at the University of Maine. He spoke at the second annual Maine Biz Powering Up Maine Conference in South Portland. You may order a copy of today's broadcast by calling MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. You can listen to the program again at any time or hear a roundtable discussion that followed Dr. Dagher's speech by going to our website, mpbn.net. Then click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts. There is also an archive of many past Speaking in Maine programs. That's at mpbn.net. I'm Barry Darling. Thanks for listening.